It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Saturday marks the start of open enrollment for Americans who get their health insurance through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. And with pandemic-era health insurance subsidies set to expire at the end of this year, premiums are expected to spike.
Democrats on Capitol Hill have made extending the health insurance tax credits the centerpiece of their demands to support reopening the government.
In Wisconsin, more than 310,000 people purchased their 2025 health insurance through the ACA marketplace. That's according to the Wisconsin Office of the Commissioner of Insurance. Yesterday, that office released 2026 projections for how much premiums would go up for select groups of enrollees.
For a look at these costs and what to know about shopping for health insurance now, we're joined by Bobby Peterson, founder, executive director, and a public interest attorney at ABC for Health. That's a nonprofit public interest law firm in Wisconsin focused on access to health care coverage. Bobby, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, great to be here. Thank you.
So the Evers administration releases these projections for how much premiums will increase through the ACA marketplace. What stands out to you about these numbers?
Yeah, I think it's shocking, but it's not shocking when we see the withdrawal of some of these advanced premium tax credits and the pools out there becoming more restricted. That just means that, you know, the insurance companies are thinking more that there's going to be less healthy people in the pools because they might opt out and not choose insurance. But it is a symptom of a problematic healthcare system that we have. Health insurance is going up rapidly right now, and it's going to keep going, I think.
Bobby, how accurate are these projections from state officials, and how much could they change come Saturday?
Yeah, I think that the prices probably are fairly accurate. I think that there's always going to be some adjustments, but these companies have been looking at these for months and reviewing them based upon their projections of enrollments, new enrollments, people who aren't going to re-enroll. So there's a lot of time and energy spent in them. So I think the projections are going to be largely accurate. There's going to be some adjustments, though.
We've been hearing from state officials, from lawmakers on Capitol Hill, and during Monday's press conference, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin pointed to some specific projections from the Evers administration for health insurance premiums in Wisconsin. And here's the scenario she brought up.
A 60-year-old couple in Barron County making $85,000 a year will see an increase of over 800% in their premiums. That is a $33,000 increase, more than a third of that couple's entire income. For more than 275,000 Wisconsinites, care is about to get drastically more expensive.
Okay, so Bobby, can you break that down for us? Baldwin highlighting this data for a 60-year-old couple in a rural area. Are older adults seeing the biggest increase in premiums?
Yeah, I think it's really looking at both, the age and the income level. So these advanced premium tax credits that were passed during the COVID pandemic and through in 2021 as well, I think that they identified groups to reduce premiums for, but that was in that moderate income range that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. So once those are taken away, you're going to see some pretty big increases in expenses for them, for their insurance, because they will not be eligible for advanced premium tax credits. And that's what the whole, battle right now is over, is how can we extend these advanced premium tax credits to more people that currently have them, that would lose them in 2026? Is this something that we should do? Because they are going to face pretty big increases in their insurance.
So with that in mind, what should people starting to shop on the marketplace have in mind if they plan on, if they see that their plan they're on now is too expensive for their budget?
Yeah, they may not even know it yet. As we looked this morning, the window shopping tool wasn't open yet. But so the window shopping tool usually opens any day now so that you can go in and take a look at the exact cost of the plans in your area. We checked this morning. It wasn't up yet. But I think it's still a good idea to get into, if you have a current plan, go into the marketplace, update your information, update your projected your income information. you know, one of the things that we're telling some of our clients, and it's, you know, it's a case by case situation. This is the thing about healthcare coverage and services is that everyone's got a different set of circumstances. Their income could be going up. Their income could be going down. They could be retiring in a month. They could be eligible for Medicare in 2 or 3 months. So it's really individualized. So it's hard to make large scale projections of like what everyone should do. But I think the takeaway is that it's a good idea to look at your situation and maybe not jump the gun on November 1st, wait some time because things are changing fast. I mean, if there are negotiations that happen, you know, probably not going to happen this week, maybe next week. But as things thaw a little bit in relationships between the president, you know, Congress, it may be that we see some changes and some negotiations occurring. It might be better to hold off a bit before you pull the trigger on securing healthcare coverage for 2026. You've got some time until December 15th to make that decision.
Oh, so definitely keep an eye on what's happening on Capitol Hill because, you know, you can hold back and not make a decision till later in the enrollment period in case we do get more information and insurers need to adjust their prices.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it might be beneficial to wait. It's certainly, you know, you want to make sure you've got coverage starting in January of 2026. So that December 15th deadline is going to be important to keep an eye on. But there's, like I said, there's a lot of other variables to consider. What's your income situation? What's your expected income? How are things going to be changing for you over the course of the year? What type of plan is going to be best for you given your circumstances, your healthcare needs, your medication needs, and things like that? So there's definitely some homework to do, but I think it's a homework period versus actually selecting a plan right away for most people.
Bobby Peterson with us, founder and executive director of the nonprofit public law firm ABC for Health. We're talking about the open enrollment period for the ACA marketplace that starts Saturday and how to navigate increasing costs as federal pandemic area subsidies are set to expire. Bobby, do these projections reflect at all what employees should expect to pay for private insurance through their employer? Is this a bellwether of sorts?
I would say yes, because I think when we look at, you know, at the costs of health insurance, a lot of it has to do with, you know, the pool of people that are securing insurance. So the risk pool is the term of art. And so if people decide I'm pretty healthy, so I'm not going to apply for insurance, I'm not going to take insurance, that means that risk pool gets more risky, and that there's fewer healthy people in there to balance out the people that might have a lot of chronic illnesses or conditions. You know, that was the whole concept behind the Affordable Care Act, to try and build these larger pools, blend the risk, and hopefully help create some market pressures to keep prices down. Well, when a lot of people opt out of getting coverage, that defeats the purpose a bit, and it undermines the opportunities to provide coverage to more people at an affordable price sometimes.
What might be happening right now with off-exchange plans or these alternative ACA-compliant plans? Sometimes they're called through like a broker or directly from an insurance company. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a difference between, you know, what, just let's go to the other end of the spectrum, which is the junk plans that you might find a website that offers you something that's just too good to be true. Be very skeptical of it. I think, you know, generally going through healthcare.gov is going to be a better opportunity for you, going through a broker or an agent, making sure you're getting an ACA compliant plan, because otherwise you could be subject to a plan that is pretty threadbare, has a lot of exclusions, and you might end up with quite a few more medical bills. You know, people confuse sometimes, instead of going to healthcare.gov, they go to healthcare.com. And it's a big difference in the quality and the types of plans that are available.
So if you want help from a navigator, are federally certified health insurance navigators affected by the government shutdown? What resources are out there for people who want help in this process?
Yeah, that's another one of the, you know, important legs of the Affordable Care Act that was kind of knocked out. The Navigator program was reduced by 90% by the Trump administration. And it's, you know, as you, as most of the listeners know, this stuff is not easy to understand. It's complicated. It's nice to have people that have the training, the understanding to help you identify the paths that are available. Now, Covering Wisconsin still has a Navigator program that are available to help people. There's a website that's for Wisconsin called wiscovered.com that people can go to get some information about, make appointments and try and identify, you know, questions that they might have for a Navigator. And I would encourage people to do that because, as I said, it's very individualized. There's so many variables to consider sometimes based upon your family income, your family size, tax credits that might be available or are expiring. I mean, they'll be able to help you with current, up-to-date, timely information to help you make the best decision for yourself and your family.
Bobby, you've been in this for a long time, working very closely in healthcare access. What are you watching for from lawmakers in the fifth week of the shutdown as they grapple with the cost of health insurance in this country?
I mean, I think there's, you know, this short-term and long-term issues. You can't just, you know, fix the health insurance problem and the advanced premium tax credits without dealing with the overall cost of healthcare. That's a separate issue. The cost of healthcare is sometimes something that, you know, it's a much tougher fight sometimes, but you have to get to the overall root cause of why the insurance premiums are going up. The cost of care is the real issue, and we need to think about strategies and ways to promote large-scale pooling, promote efficiencies of administration. And those are things that we can do, but we just don't have the political will to accomplish that right now.
Bobby, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to help.
That is attorney Bobby Peterson, founder and executive director of ABC for Health. It's a nonprofit public interest law firm in Wisconsin focused on healthcare access. We talked about the open enrollment period that begins Saturday for Affordable Care Act health insurance plans and how to navigate increasing costs as government subsidies are set to expire that have brought down the price of these premiums in the past.
Coming up, a bill in Wisconsin would open up access to online sports gambling hosted by tribal casinos. A sponsor of the bill gives us the details.
So really, it's just giving everyone access to the online markets that the rest of the country is enjoying that our state has not had access to.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today.
Listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Ken.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's peak pumpkin season, and in the Midwest, there's a thriving community of pumpkin growers harvesting gourds that are bigger and heavier than some cars.
Harvest Public Media contributor Peter Medlin reports.
The Pumpkin House sits in a quiet neighborhood in suburban Chicagoland. If you drive by, you'd never expect some of the Midwest's biggest pumpkins grow here in Joe Atkins' backyard garden.
Yeah, I grow the ones that are under a pound all the way up to hopefully a couple thousand pounds.
Joe's won the Illinois Giant Pumpkin Growers Association's annual weigh-off multiple years in a row. And last year, he cracked a personal milestone, his first 2,000-pound pumpkin. He's always loved pumpkins, but it was actually pumpkin carving that got him into pumpkin growing. He just wanted a bigger canvas.
I decided that I wanted to carve these big pumpkins like this, and I couldn't find them anywhere to buy them. So I thought, well, let me give it a shot. I'll try to grow one, and then I can carve it that way. And I couldn't believe how much I love growing those pumpkins.
Cultivating a giant pumpkin patch is a ton of work year-round. Joe sprays fungicide, prunes and berries vines, even sets up fans to stop moisture and rot.
It's literally like 4 or 5 hours a day. I've got a schedule. On Sundays and Tuesdays, I do about 8 hours.
Here's a wild thing about giant pumpkins. They get that heavy really fast. In June and July, they can grow more than 50 pounds in one day. And Joe's 2,000-pounder is not the Illinois state record, and it's not even close to the world record. That recently belonged to Minnesota horticulture teacher Travis Ginger. In 2023, he drove his giant pumpkin to California and set the world record.
Okay. I'm going to hit the switch right now. 2,749!
It was the realization of a lifelong dream. His dad grew big pumpkins, and as a teenager, he announced to his classmates that he would break the world record one day. Ginger says back then, the record was 700 or 800 pounds. It's tripled since and not slowing down.
It's gotten kind of crazy, and I mean, now a new grower can go grow a 2,000-pounder, no problem. It takes a lot of work, don't get me wrong, but the world of the internet has really pushed this thing quite a bit.
As the pumpkins grow and records shatter, the technology and techniques get more sophisticated. Growers can spend hundreds of dollars for just one seed. Some grow these pumpkins on scales inside climate-controlled greenhouses hooked up to sensors. And the hobby itself is also growing. There are giant pumpkin weigh-offs and festivals all over the country. Del Faust is the president of the Wisconsin Giant Pumpkin Growers, and he says their group has doubled in size to 200 members since he joined in 2012, and Wisconsin recently hosted an international growers conference.
The worldwide one last year was up in Green Bay at Lambeau Field, so people from all over the world came to learn more about growing giant pumpkins.
I got 31 on this one.
Back in Illinois, this year's weigh-off is getting started. Joe Adkins looks to defend his title from a field of 12 or so other growers.
If it's your first time joining us, welcome! If it's not, welcome back!
Pumpkins up to 1,500 pounds tip the scale through the afternoon, but it comes down to the last pumpkin, Joe's pumpkin, and the weight to beat is 1882. The pumpkin lasso latches onto a forklift and gently hoists the giant gourd into the sky. The crowd holds their breath and looks to the scale.
2,026 pounds!
Yeah! Joe wins, beating his personal record by just 5 pounds. And then he loads up his prize winner onto the trailer to haul it home. He plans to carve it for Halloween and hand out seeds to trick-or-treaters, hopefully to inspire the next generation of giant pumpkin growers. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Peter Medlin.
This is Wisconsin Today.
The Wisconsin Constitution currently bars sports gambling outside of tribal grounds. But a bill introduced last week by a bipartisan group of lawmakers would let tribes set up servers on tribal land, and users could legally connect with and gamble on those servers from anywhere in the state.
This comes as Wisconsin's Ho-Chunk Nation is suing the companies Kelce and Robinhood, alleging that they're already operating illegal online sports betting operations in the state. And we'll dig into that part of the story in just a bit.
First State Senator Kristen Dasler-Alfheim of Appleton is a co-author of the new legislation. She's a Democrat representing a district in the Fox Cities. Senator Dasler-Alfheim, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so you've joined this group, bipartisan group of lawmakers, with this expansion of gambling legislation. Why do this now, first of all?
Well, one, anytime we can start working together across the aisles, I think it's a good choice. And in this case, it's just a matter of opening up a tool that we already have access to in gambling in the state of Wisconsin. This would allow the rest of Wisconsin to take care of the online access, which 37 or 38 other states in Wisconsin, in the country, already have. So really, it's just giving everyone access to the online markets that the rest of the country is enjoying that our state has not had access to via the spoken wheel method.
Now, we've had, initially in Wisconsin's Constitution, gambling was just right out. We've loosened that up bit by bit over the years. Then court rulings on tribal gambling loosened things up more. How would it work in your legislation, opening things up for tribes to operate statewide online sports gambling?
Yes, so it is part of our compact with the tribes that they are allowed to provide gambling. And obviously, Wisconsin endorses that. We even have our own Powerball and our scratch-off tickets. So this just would allow them to, with the wheel and spoke method, allows them to have access off of their grounds to the online sports betting world. Right now, you can enter their facility and bet on the same things. This just allows the mobile access to those DraftKings-type models that everyone sees as they're watching their sports on Sunday.
Have you been watching how this works in other states? I think Florida was one of the first states to have this kind of model.
Yeah, it's not new legislation. Like I said, there are 37 or 38 other states that have already approved it and are using it successfully. Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico. This is not new legislation. We're a little slow to act.
What do you see as the revenue side of things for state government here, knowing that there's some compact negotiation that would have to happen?
Yeah, certainly the tribes will be contracting with multiple sources. Our assumption is that it's going to be about a 10% increase. So if currently it's about $66 million, it should kick in perhaps another $6 to $8 million. It really is a little bit of a guess, as until it's up and running, we won't know the true volume.
One concern is that, and I've talked to people who are experts on online gambling, not everyone who gambles is going to be a problem gambler, but some people will. And having it so that, in effect, the casino is in your pocket for people who do develop compulsive gambling problems, it's going to be bigger. What kind of steps would you want to see either in this legislation or in a negotiated compact to help deal with the consequences of problem gambling?
I think in all cases, and that exists today, there are entertaining gamblers, social gamblers, and then there are those that have a problem. That doesn't change with access to this tool. Those that are compulsive gamblers already are accessing every tool that they have. We need to continue to offer resources and education to everyone to make sure they have the help they need. That will continue to be a problem. It is the rest of the dynamic, the rest of the people who are just using it for entertainment, that we're allowing to have them have access to a tool that everybody else already has.
Now, we've got in the news today this arrest of some NBA players, coaches, former players, a former Milwaukee Buck, in fact, because of the influence of gambling, organized crime on these kind of sports bets. Do you worry that expanding this kind of gambling in Wisconsin could lead to more corruption in our sports, professional, maybe even at the college level?
Listen, every industry, there are people that lack integrity. And in this case, this is our sports professionals. I don't think in any way someone who it can self, I don't think they should be able to self-deal. If you are playing a professional sport or managing a professional sport, you should not have the ability to gamble on that sport. That is an integrity issue that if it can't be managed personally by personal choices, then there could be legislation on that. People involved in the sport should not be commanding those bets. That's a given question. That is an integrity issue with the individuals that are playing and managing those sports.
And as we wrap up, you've got some bipartisan sponsorship on this bill. What do you see as a timeline and the prospects for this thing passing?
Well, I hope that it gets its hearing and we can all have some public input on it. So if there are any changes that are needed or that we're missing, we can take care of that and add it in, amend it, whatever necessary. And then we can move it through the Assembly and the Senate rather quickly. There are only so many opportunities in the Senate calendar, but we have a few yet this year. And so I'm hoping it moves forward in time for those.
Senator Dazzler Alfheim, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was State Senator Kristen Dazzler Alfheim of Appleton. She was talking about new legislation that would legalize online gambling throughout Wisconsin. This debate over sports gambling comes as a lawsuit from Wisconsin's Ho-Chunk Nation alleges that prediction markets, Kalshi and Robinhood, are already facilitating online sports betting in Wisconsin. The tribe sued both companies in August, arguing that the services are effectively operating illegal online sports books in the state. To learn more, we're joined by Alexander Osipovich. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, covering exchanges, market structure, and cryptocurrencies. He's following this story. Alexander, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
This might be new to some people. These prediction markets working in the sports field. Kalshi isn't the one that's in Wisconsin news because of a lawsuit. What are these things? How do they work? How do they differ from those, you know, DraftKings or FanDuel's that people might be more familiar with?
Prediction markets are exchanges where people can basically bet on future events. Usually the way they're set up is that you bet yes or no on some question. So for instance, will Donald Trump win the presidential election? You can bet on that. And if you're right, at the end of the day, you win a dollar. If you're wrong, you get zero. And in between, before it settles, it is some price. And that price is a certain number of cents, which represents the percentage likelihood of it happening. So if Donald Trump shares are trading at 60 cents, it means there is a 60% chance of him winning the election in the wisdom of the market. These things can cover a lot of different territories. They can have bets on, you know, whether a hurricane will hit Florida this year. Traditionally, they did not get into sports because that was seen as the domain of state regulators, and it was not something that the prediction markets did. But recently, Kalshi and a couple others have begun doing this in sports.
They've been doing this in sports, in part, as I understand it, because of a ruling in their past efforts, especially in presidential elections, saying a court saying, well, no, this isn't gambling. This is a futures market. Do I have that right? And did that open the door some for them?
The court ruling that really changed things took place late last year and it allowed Kalshi to offer betting on elections. This court ruling also kind of unsettled the law and made it unclear what sort of things were allowed and what weren't allowed. And Kalshi decided beginning of this year to offer contracts on the Super Bowl and other types of sporting events like March Madness. And this coincided with the Trump administration taking office. The Trump administration is pretty relaxed when it comes to financial regulation. And the regulator that oversees Kalshi, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, has basically not really done anything to stop this from happening.
How widespread now is the sports part of this, not gambling, this prediction market right now?
So Kalshi operates in all 50 states. It has a federal license and says that gives it the right to basically offer this everywhere, even in states where there are state-level prohibitions against the traditional kind of gambling. There are definitely some states that are upset about this. Kalshi is fighting in court with a number of different state regulators that are saying, hey, you're offering these contracts that are effectively the same as sports bets, and we want to stop you from doing that. So far, Kalshi has been able to hold its ground and has not been forced to stop offering its sports contracts in any state. And apparently it's actually doing quite well. With the start of NFL season, their trading volumes really took off. And they are beginning to be a real threat to the traditional sports books.
Right. So if I wanted to place a bet on the Packer game this weekend, I said, I'll bet a dollar that the Packers will win. And I don't go to a tribal casino. That bet is illegal. If I go to a futures market and invest a dollar, put a dollar at stake on that future, according to Kalshi, and so far courts, I guess that is legal.
Kalshi says it's legal. So far, its lawyers have won most of the initial rounds in court, but it is a legally unsettled area. There are a number of gambling lobbying groups that are very upset about this. Kalshi has also been sued by some Indian tribes. And ultimately, it may take the Supreme Court to resolve this question.
Right. Wisconsin's Ho-Chunk Nation is why we're talking to you right now. They have joined one of these lawsuits against Kalshi and Robinhood. They're joining lawsuits in others that joins lawsuits in other states. How common is it for tribal groups like the Ho-Chunk are now to be suing Kalshi and these other operations?
There were some tribes in California which sued Kalshi earlier this year, and they basically make a similar argument. They say that this infringes on tribal sovereignty, and it's from a big picture level, it's similar to what the states are saying. They're saying that Kalshi should not be getting into this area.
market scope. How do these prediction markets that offer ways to make predictions on the outcomes of sporting events, how does their market compare to, you know, the DraftKings and FanDuel that we see all these ads for?
So far, they are still relatively small. From my discussions with people in this industry, my understanding is that they're not really a big threat to DraftKings or FanDuel yet. They haven't taken a lot of business. But where they are a threat is that they can operate in states where there is no traditional sports betting. DraftKings and FanDuel can't operate in California or Texas. And there are a number of other states like that. Whereas Kalshi has this argument saying that we have a federal license, we can go all 50 states. So what's actually happening now is that the traditional sports books are looking to acquire prediction markets. DraftKings just announced it was buying something called the Railbird Exchange, which is a federally licensed exchange that it could potentially use to offer sports trading nationwide.
So it seems like the doors are wide open, right? If I want to risk money based on the outcome of a game or subsets thereof, there's going to be an opportunity for me to do it with all these guys getting into this prediction market.
You're right. I would say that there are a few things different about the prediction markets and sports. So, for instance, when you are betting in a traditional sports book, you are betting against the house. There is a sports book that amasses all these different bets, sets the odds, and that's who you are facing off against. And ultimately, the way these sports books make money is they make money from losers. You lose money and they get a cut of that, and they pay out some of it to the winners. On a prediction market, it's a bit different because you are actually facing other traders. So a bunch of people are betting for one team, other people are betting on the other team, and these things face off against each other in the same way that buyers and sellers in the stock market determine the prices of stocks. So the people who run prediction markets would argue that this is a little bit fairer. And they also make money differently. They don't make money from losers or from winners. What they do is they make money from fees every time somebody buys in or out of the market.
Alexander, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Alexander Osipovich is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal covering exchanges, market structures, and cryptocurrencies. We also talked to State Senator Kristen Dalzer-Alfheim about a new gambling law here in the state.
Coming up, a pair of first responders talk about their work and service to their communities in times of crisis.
Hostage situations don't happen every day, but I use my negotiation skills daily and weekly with negotiating with suicidal subjects.
The people honored as Wisconsin's first responders of the year, that's next.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Today is National First Responders Appreciation Day. In Wisconsin, First Responders of the Year were recognized at the state capitol this month.
99 first responders, one for each state assembly district, were honored for their courage and service. Today we meet two of them.
Caleb Lucht is a lieutenant firefighter for Lake Country Fire and Rescue in Delafield. Caleb was recognized for rescuing a woman and her dog from the second story of a burning building. Lieutenant Luck, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Take us back to this emergency. About 11 o'clock at night, calls come in that a Delafield apartment complex is on fire. You get the call. Then what happened?
So just a little backstory. I was in the city of Delafield. I was on our ladder truck. We were responding with a crew of five, and battalion chief was first on scene, as well as police, gave a really good description as far as what's on fire. It was a 8-family apartment building. We've been there before and knew the layout pretty well. The crew that I was with entailed a driver, a pumps the rig. But it wasn't my regularly assigned driver. We have something called a trade. So they switched shifts. So it was a different driver that day. And then I had a more seasoned firefighter with me who ended up doing an amazing job. And then also I had two younger firefighters, one with his first month on the job and the other one had 12 hours on the job.
Wow.
As far as a firefighter. So a lot of youth, but also young and willing to work. So responded to the fire, had a good layout as our idea of what the layout was. Again, descriptions by dispatch as well as police department. And then also our first in battalion chief basically said that fire was blowing out of the first floor patio.
First floor apartment totally engulfed in flames. Then you learn on your radio someone is inside who needs rescuing on the second floor. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So something that we ended up doing at, just with my background, learned to do is splitting our crews. And because we had a crew of five, we were able to do so while also still being safe and having accountability of each other. So we got a good knock on the fire initially, trying to make a, what we call it, make a push. Sounds a little crazy if you're not within the first responder world. But yeah, you're just going after the heat and trying to knock it down as fast as you can. At that time, I heard it on the radio, so I actually grabbed a member who had a month on the job and realized that I had a younger member with me as a as the boss. I want to keep the youngest person with me just, again, for that safety aspect. So I kind of told him, hey, stay with the hose line. Jen's new, the senior firefighter, the one running the nozzle, firefighter Jen's, he knew exactly what to do, and he was after it and kept accountability with that other member. And myself and the youngest guy with 12 hours, I pulled him with me and we were going upstairs right above the fire. So.
You find a woman and her dog, from what I understand. What was that like when you entered this apartment?
The stairwell was fully and filled with smoke. So we knew that was not an exit point. She did a nice job locking her doors, closing her doors, her bedroom door as well. So there was a lot of protection between the stairwell and her apartment, but knew that we had to go outside the window. Funny interaction was she really wanted her dog to go first. And
this was like a lab, right?
Yeah. It was a lab. And as a pet owner myself, I get it, but just not how things work. So gave a good chuckle. And again, a lot of other members on scene did an excellent job setting up a ladder. So we had already had a ladder close by and she went out the window and then followed with her dog.
You hand the dog to another firefighter on the ladder. What was that like?
I don't know. I guess you really don't think of personal things when you're not doing your job. It's a more professional aspect. I was looking for the next thing and right away going on to search to make sure the rest of the building was clear.
You kept the building from coming down, you and your crew. How did you do that?
So in a firefighting, there's basically priorities, right? There's simplistically, it's either take the hazard from the victim or the victim from the hazard. That's either putting water in the fire, which take away the hazard, or you remove the victim and now you took them away from the fire. So we did those two operations of suppression as well as the rescue. And then when we exited, cause we were, had to change out our bottles, the fire extended up into the eaves of the apartment complex. And, you know, buildings are meant to ventilate and breathe and get rid of moisture. And so once it gets up in the eaves, it's usually going to lose a building. So right away, we went right to work. And what we do is we essentially ladder the roof and cut a hole in the roof and make it a chimney. That way it can self-ventilate. And just knowing fire behavior, it wants to go up. Right? Smoke and heat rise. And so as a crew of five members performing that task, not just one of the tasks, but all three of the primary objectives of the fire is incredible. And it's a testament to their work.
We are speaking with Caleb Lucht, Lieutenant Firefighter for Lake Country Fire and Rescue in Delafield. Now we turn to another award-winning first responder. Julie Powell is an officer with the Antigo Police Department and a board member of the Wisconsin Crisis Negotiators Association. Officer Powell, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You helped to save children by negotiating a violent hostage situation. Can you take us through what happened that day?
Sure. So it was June of 2023. The initial call came in at around 8:48 p.m. When officers arrived on scene. They quickly established that they had a domestic violence situation. They were able to make contact with the female and quickly identify that her children were still left in the house with a violent individual, which was her boyfriend at the time. When officers made the initial approach to make contact with him, he quickly said, leave me alone. I have high powered rifles. And he made threats quickly with that. So officers pulled back and they called in extra help, which would be our special response team. So we were deployed to assist quickly with that.
Wow. How did you build trust and rapport with a hostage taker very quickly? What is that like?
It was a high stress, high tense situation, but it's what we train for. So we were to quickly establish contact with him, and we did that by the victim's Facebook. So that was their primary means of communication. We used her phone, actually, and we were able to negotiate with him and speak with him for hours on end, actually. It's just kind of a, you know what your goal is, and your goal is to keep those kids safe and everyone at that scene safe. So we worked through the situation at hand and, established a rapport with him by just kind of talking about him, his childhood, kind of what led us to the day and how we were going to work through it.
When children are involved in a situation like this, does that change your tactics in crisis negotiation at all?
Well, it definitely heightens the stress quite a bit, right? Because they're two innocent children that are 6 and 8, and they had an idea of what was going on. Our goal with any negotiation when there's hostages involved is to preserve life and their safety. So it was very, very tense, but we worked really hard. We brought in additional resources quickly with other departments and really just communicated and worked to resolve the situation, I guess, if that makes sense.
Your voice must stay calm in a situation like this. What does that feel like inside your body?
It's a lot of note taking. So I will on a notepad write calm and reference that, and your coach, which is sitting next to you, listening to everything and assisting you with mitigating the situation. If they see that something is starting to kind of bug you or your tone is changing, they'll point to that. When contact is broken or for some reason he hangs up on you, which happened quite frequently, but then he would call back. You have those times in between the phone calls to kind of decompress, talk about what's working, what's not working. Oh. What is a hook to be able to kind of bring him back to essentially the reality that you're speaking about and work through those tasks.
You aren't faced with hostage negotiations on a regular basis. How do your highly specialized negotiation skills, how do they come into play in your day-to-day work as an officer?
Oh, absolutely. We use them every day. They're very important. Obviously, communication in our line of work is a huge factor in how we resolve problems and issues. So hostage situations don't happen every day, probably, and hopefully once and only once do I ever have to deal with that again. But I use my negotiation skills daily and weekly with negotiating with suicidal subjects. My empathy and my active listening skills with individuals who, not everyone likes a cop, right? And not everyone wants to be taken into custody if you have to make an arrest. So using your verbal judo skills to to kind of essentially, I don't want to say talk them into cuffs, but arresting them peacefully so you're not fighting with them and no one's getting hurt.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that story. I want to turn back to you, Lieutenant Lucht. You know, in terms of challenges, I know you've experienced when responding to a fire that there may not be fire hydrants around. Is this more of a challenge as a firefighter that you face when there isn't a fire hydrant around?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a hydrant is essentially a unlimited water supply. When you don't have that, there's a lot more coordination as far as the fire scene itself, because you're trucking in water, you know, with tenders and tankers, and using the resources that you have on scene, as well as being a lot more diligent with your hose, that you're putting on the fire and your water supply. And it's a huge resource burden.
You have both told stories that just don't happen each day. They're high-stakes situations. They're not daily occurrences, but they do happen. I want to ask each of you, how do you take care of yourself and stay uplifted and motivated to come back to work when a day has been really stressful and heavy? Lieutenant Lucht, you first.
Well, I think there's like the self-wellness things. I'm a busybody. So whether it's some kind of crafting with leather work, or right now it's hunting season. So that's a passion of mine. I've got a family, 3 kids under 5. So they keep me occupied. But the motivation to go back is always, people would say like the guys and gals, the people back at the firehouse, the mentorship, the ability to kind of cope together is huge.
Sounds like you find family also on your team, the fellow firefighters.
Absolutely. I mean, a third of the year we spend together. So we spend Christmases, kids' birthdays, whether it's at the firehouse or on our personal level, too. We're always together.
For you, Officer Powell, what helps you through the hard times?
It's absolutely remembering the moment that you've seen those children come out safely and how rewarding it was. Every day is not the same, obviously, in law enforcement, but it's rewarding in the fact that you're helping people and you're seeing a difference and you're making a change. Most times it's people's worst day that they're coming in contact with you. And I still have the children drew pictures and thank you letters, and I still have them hanging laminated on my locker. So every day that I gear up and grab my equipment, I see that. And it's kind of like the why and the it's why we do it and why we continue to answer the call and continue with our profession. It's the reward.
Do you ever go back and think through the pieces of what happened at all, or any type of postmortem like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's happened years later, and I still think about, like, different aspects of it. Like, if we would have said this, or if we would have done this, like, would we come out sooner, or would the children not have to hear, I guess, as long as what they did for as long as they did. But everything worked out peacefully. Everyone was safe. Everyone went home at the end of the day. He didn't get hurt. He ended up where he needed to be in custody, thankfully, peacefully. So,
well, thank you both for your service, Officer Powell and Lieutenant Lucht. Thank you so much for being here.
No, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That is Julie Powell, officer with the Antico Police Department, and Caleb Lucht, lieutenant firefighter for Lake Country Fire and Rescue in Delafield. They are two of Wisconsin's first responders of the year.
Earlier today, we looked at the 2026 premiums for health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act marketplace.
And we want to hear about your experiences as you look at health care costs and any questions you have.
Whether you get coverage on the ACA marketplace or through an employer, Medicaid via Badger Care, or if there's nothing on the table that works for you, we want to hear your perspective on the costs of health coverage.
Email your story or your questions to us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Trevor Hook, and Avery Lee Rogers.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.